that's the reason that I'm here. It's not here to talk about what patents were or what patents will be in the future, because I don't know really very much about that, quite honestly. What I would like to do is to give you a brief thumbnail sketch of the patent system, and more specifically, what it means to the company or to the vendor. And then perhaps talk about some of the things that are a misconception about it. And then finish up with the economics of the patent, which is oftentimes misunderstood as well. If all of this works over here.
What ain't patent? Now, as I say, we'll get talk about what's known as a utility patent. And what the thing that a patent gives someone, a utility patent, is a 14-year right to prevent others from making, using, or selling the thing that is covered by the patent. That's what it amounts to. But what's implicit, what's important in that statement is no one, not even the patent owner, has an automatic right to build that piece of equipment, make, use, or sell that piece of equipment, or without possibly infringing on someone else's patent. That's a very important point. Most often, that's very much misunderstood. Someone has this piece of paper and says, whoopee, here I go. When the patent office issues a patent, they do not, in the slightest, concern themselves with whether or not that patent, if that invention that the patent covers, whether it's made, used, or sold, will infringe on someone else's record. So you just don't. So what you really, if you turn it all around, what it amounts to is you have a right to prevent others, but you don't have the right to make it, necessarily. Okay? The other important thing is that to get protection in foreign countries, you need to have a patent, or anyone needs to have a patent, from that country itself. You cannot have a U.S. patent that's going to protect you. There are some twists to that, but generally, in any other country, you need a foreign patent itself. Okay? That means that if you want a patent in Italy, you have to go to Italy and by procedure and say, I want a patent. Now, if I want a patent in France, I have to do the same thing. If I want in Germany, I have to do the same thing. And each one of those costs you bucks, which is kind of the end of my talk here when I get to it. The most important part of a patent is the patent claim. These claims, this is what, you know, the claims claim, it's kind of obvious. What's different, sufficiently different about this patent to make it patentable? And it's those 7 or 8 or 1 or 2 or 7 or 10 or 15, whatever things that are listed in the back of the patent. The rest of the stuff is good stuff, and it's all background, and it's necessary, but what's important are those claims. Now, it's important to understand that it's very difficult to write claims. And that, plus the problem of getting a patent through the Patent and Trademark Office in such a format so that it's accepted, is why patent attorneys and patent agents make a living. That, plus trying to decide whether it's worth the expense in the first place. The way a patent is examined is that each claim is compared to the prior art that we discussed earlier. And before a patent is issued, every one of those claims has to be patentable. So what will happen is you'll issue a patent, you'll submit a patent application, and the examiner will say, I like 1, 2, and 3, but 4 stinks, you see. So you can do something with 4, you don't get it back. Back to the economics of it, another thing that's very important about a patent is that it doesn't have to be better than prior art. It just has to be sufficiently different. That means I could get a patent on something that has no commercial value whatsoever. It costs more to manufacture, it could be harder to use, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when people say, gee, I have a patent, well, that may or may not be a value. Depending, of course, unless they want one for cocktail purposes or something, you know, discuss the cocktail part. Here's a little diagram that talks a little bit about, that expresses this issue of, it talks about the possibility of infringing on someone else's patent. What it is we call it the pyramid of patentability. I don't know if it's down there or not. Pyramid of patentability. And it wraps up the concept of prior art and the whole thing. It's intended to, for explanation purposes, we make the assumption that patents don't expire. We talked earlier about the 17-year right. To put another way, a patent expires in 17 years. So we assume here that at the top, Fred Flintstone, or someone like that, got himself a patent on a wheel. And he said generally that wheel is a short cylinder with a hole in the middle for a load-bearing axle. And when he did that, we assume that's the first patent on a wheel, which obviously is a ridiculous story in itself, but when he did that, he kind of set the course for all future wheels. Along came the lady or gentleman that decided that he wanted to patent on a bicycle wheel. Now, he might have, his patent claim might have said something about he has spokes and bearings or something of that nature. And the heavy black line here indicates that indicates where prior art exists. In other words, when the Flintstone wheel came into play, he said he had developed certain prior art. Now, when the bicycle wheel inventor wanted to patent the bicycle wheel, he obviously was still doing a wheel, still building a wheel, so some of that technology still was applied to, came from the Flintstone patent. But some of it was new. At the time the patent was issued, it was outside the prior art pyramid. So therefore, the patent was issued. Then along comes the automobile wheel guy, and he has a pneumatic tire and some other things. Obviously, again, to build a wheel, he needs to use some of the technology both from the bicycle wheel and the Flintstone wheel, but he had some new stuff out here. So he got a patent on the new stuff. And when that became patentable, when the patent was issued, it then contributed to prior art. So what you wind up with is a pyramid. So if someone else came around with another wheel, you'd have the same concept. Now, the important thing about this is that the concept of blocking patents. If I'm sitting here with the bicycle wheel patent, and I say, I want to build a bicycle wheel, and if this patent has not expired, which is one of the assumptions in my little diagram here, then I have to get his permission to be able to use this technology to build a wheel. If I am an automobile, if I have the automobile patent and I want to build an automobile wheel, I have to get his permission and his permission. So I don't have anything about his permission. Of course, you know, these guys die, these patents die after 17 years, so sooner or later, I don't have to ask the next guy up the line for permission. But what he has done still contributes to prior art. He still makes it more difficult to get a patent, but I can build that wheel without infringing on his patent. So, as you look up this diagram, what you're really looking at is blocking patents. This patent, being the first patent, or the basic patent, it blocks this from being built, and it blocks this from being built. The bicycle wheel blocks this from being built. If I had a Flintstone patent, I could build anything I wanted to build. I could build a Flintstone wheel. I couldn't build this or this, but I could build a Flintstone wheel. Kind of simple. We have a little diagram, but it isn't all that difficult. It's important to remember, however, that even though we're talking about hundreds of years or thousands of years between those, this scenario really is kind of the way the world is today, because there's not a lot of actually new technology. There's not a lot of basic Flintstone wheels. So when you have a patent, it generally would be infringing on someone else's if you went ahead and just build that thing. Keeping in mind that when you get a patent, the Patent Trademark Office, the people that issue the patent, pay no attention to who you would infringe upon or not infringe upon if you in fact built the device. The process of developing an invention, there are some important dates which we'll just sketch over, and I won't bother talking about any of this stuff at the bottom of it. The day that the idea is conceived, that is to the point where it can be taken over by someone of average intelligence in that technology without further instruction, and that is witness to that fact, then that's the date of conception. That's the beginning of the whole process, if you will. I should say that, let me go back here and say for a second, these three dates here really come into play in the patent process when there's an interference problem. When someone has asked for a patent at essentially the same time that you have asked for a patent. So it's important to keep records of these three things. The date of conception, which I just explained. The next is that you have to show diligence. If you just started this thing, you get the idea. And I should say, you don't even have to know that it'll work at this point. That's not important. What's important is that you started something and it's to the point where it is in fact conceived. Now you have to show diligence and actually work on that product or work on that invention, and to the point where you get to the point where you reduce it to practice. Now there's two ways to reduce it to practice. One is you can build a model, like you see in the exhibit up here. Fantastic models, incidentally. And the other is to file a patent application. Now you've reduced it to practice. So those are two important dates. There's the date of conception and the date of reduction to practice. But you'll never get a patent unless you file a patent application. And that needs to be done based on when it was first put into public use, when it was first publicized, et cetera, one-year date kind of thing. We won't go into that. But they're listed here in very short terse form. And so you wind up with having to file a patent application. So on this one slide is the whole process, if you will, of the important dates. Now let's pretend that you issue a patent application. I think that's what we're going to pretend. Let me see what this next one looks like. Yeah. Pretend that you issue a patent application. This is something we call the flow of a patent application. Once you file that patent application, then you go through a couple of reviews with the Patent and Trademark Office, abbreviated here as PTO. The first official action, and then you respond to that in the second official action. If you're lucky enough that all of the claims that you have expressed in this patent application, and you follow all the other rules of drawing and all this sort of thing, then you just may get a patent. But that doesn't happen very often, as a gentleman will tell you, but or not. So he'll come back to you, the patent examiner will come, the patent trade will come back to you and say, you have to change this, or I don't like this, or whatever. Now you issue a response to that, and you go at it one more time. If he then refuses you, then you have a couple of options, but they're not awfully strong options. This is called, you could possibly wind up in final rejection, but the important point of this slide is that this is the easy way. Getting into here, this, at this official action or that, and that's easy. After that, and that might take you a couple of years to get to this point. After that, if you still don't like the answer and you have some reasonable grounds for argument, now you have to go around and start working your way through the Board of Appeals and the courts and so forth, and you could be 5, 6, 7, 10 years around this loop. At any point, you could wind up getting a patent, but it still takes time to work and money to get around that loop. Okay. Told you this was going to be quick. All right, so all of this says that to have a patent is an extremely valuable thing if it has commercial value. Again, if you want to use it for cocktail conversations, that's fine too. But it's important to keep in mind that patents are very costly. We just itemize some of the general cost to the for this individual or small companies who on some fees get a 50% reduction. So we itemize some of those activities that you need to go through and the approximate cost, and you wind up with some number that looks like $9,000 to $14,000 at today's fees. Now that includes maintenance fees. Once a patent gets issued, then you have to maintain that patent for 7 years, you need to pay certain fees through the years, 4 years, 10 years, whatever. So you wind up with that kind of a number. And it's kind of interesting to know, again, we talked about that a patent is good for in the U.S. and its territories, et cetera, only. So if you want protection in the foreign countries, you have to go through just about that kind of expense for every foreign country that you're interested in attacking, interested in getting a patent. They have other rules. They have to do it according to their rules. So the obvious conclusion is that it's costly to get many patents. You know, you're talking 10 countries, you're $10,000 to $100,000. So that's kind of the point of the slide. So what that amounts to, when finally comes a recommendation, if you're thinking of embarking on the patent group, is after the, and this kind of summarizes the short thumbnail sketch we went through, after the date of conception that we talked about, and while you're reducing it to practice through your diligence approach, and before you file a patent application, you want to do some things, you want to do some patent searches. There's ways to do that, and ultimately you need an attorney to help you do that. But what you're trying to do there is evaluate that what you're trying to do is obvious. Again, whether it's sufficiently different to be patentable. And in addition to that, at the top block, you want to do some economic analysis about, what kind of money am I going to make on this thing if I'm interested in the money, if I make it, buy it, sell it. Or am I just having it to prevent someone else from using it? And I guess the biggest, and then of course you go through and file your patent application in the U.S. and foreign if that's of interest. And I guess if those of you that are looking at patents, what's hidden here is something pretty important in my mind, is this avoid being mesmerized. More often than not, I don't want to say that. It's very easy to say, gee, Eva, I've got this wonderful thing. Well, we're living in a very competitive economy, and where technology has to be pretty good to bring to bring returns. Any questions?
You said there are three kinds of patents: utility, design, and I missed the third.
Plant.
Plant.
Plants for plants. Flowers. That's right. It all depends. There's treaties around the world, a couple of popular treaties and a couple of less popular treaties. If the important thing about those treaties is just exactly the issue you raised. What is my time? Generally speaking, you have to 12 or 20 months to get a patent in other countries after you file it in the U.S. You have a little bit of a twist to that. In some countries, if you disclose your invention prior to filing for the patent, you can't get a patent. It's a fairly complicated procedure.
Does that allow someone else to get a patent?
In that country, I would assume.
In Spain, I know it's sometimes been the practice where even if a patent exists in another country, they basically become aware of that patent or the product and then go back to Spain. There's no real requirement that there be actual inventorship. I think they've recently changed that, but for years that was a problem. For example, at trade shows, whether it be a toy trade show or electronics or something, you'd literally get people coming over to see what the products were, go back to, for example, Spain, obtain a patent on it, then contact the company that produced the product and say, how would you like to buy your patent in Spain? That's how bad it got at times, but I believe it isn't as great a threat nowadays. But if you don't get a patent, if you don't file an application, it depends on that country's laws as to whether someone else could obtain a patent.
I just
want
to, you gave me a tally of the approximate cost
sure.
of the state, and you mentioned the search and the write-up and the application fee. Mm-hmm. And then you noted the prosecution of it. And I was just wondering that after you've written it up, what further steps, in other words, is that prosecution, does that include the iterations, the back and forth, give and take with the PTO about the...
Yeah, generally it does. But that's not, you know, that cost is generally absorbed or charged by the patent attorney.
Right. And so that is quite large. After there's a lot of change that occurs after you...
Well, no, the numbers I show here are average numbers. It could get to be higher than that. I wish you'd let these gentlemen answer that question. Yes? Yes?
How do you know who owns the prior art patents? How do you know when you're infringing on someone else's patent if they don't tell you that from the patent office? Is that part
they
of
won't
the
tell
search?
You. Okay. You have to do the search.
You do the search yourself, or you? How do you go about doing that?
Well, I tell you what I like to do. I like to, with a patent attorney, go to the patent trademark office and do the search at the patent trademark office with the patent attorney. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, you do the search, you find out. But you're also learning about what other technology is available. Some stuff you can copy because the patent is expired, you know, for other reasons you can copy. You find out who else is working in the industry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very valuable thing to do it. Very few people need to do that. Even in the large companies in this country, they don't take advantage of that patent trademark office library, which is just tremendous. Absolutely tremendous.
Approximately how long would that take? The search you're talking about with the attorney.
Well, I'm doing it for another company. I'm going to say 2 days. That kind of time. Do you agree with that?
Just 12 months.
All right. It's that kind of time. Yes.
Does the patent, if you have a U.S. patent, does it limit distribution or manufacture from other countries?
If another country manufactures your product, in that country, in say in France, just to pick something, then it cannot be used or sold in the United States. All right? If you have a process patent, a new way to make rubber, something, and you do not have a patent in France on that process, someone is trying to import a product that was made on that process, then you can have, I don't know how difficult this is, these gentlemen can tell you that, but you can have that product, you can stop that product from being imported in the United States. Yes, please.
Yeah, I was looking before your Flintstone wheel, the bike wheel, to
yes.
Car wheel flow, and trying to relate that to the concept of betweenness in mathematics, where, you know, on a real number line, if you have any two numbers, you can always find a number that's between the two.
Mm-hmm.
How can you, I mean, relating that to patents, between any two or progression of patents in time, or just in society, you can find another patent that's between the two. I mean, you can go as far as you want. I mean, for instance, with a wheel, a car wheel, I mean, there's so many things that can be added to that, like a tire pressure monitor that sends a signal back to the car or
yes.
or somewhere like that. And I'm just wondering where is the line drawn? It's got to be a practical limit that's drawn.
Perhaps.
Yeah, the lawyers here.
I'll just answer that question, but I think it really all boils down to back to the obvious question, is what you're trying to get patented. Is it obvious from prior art?
Another thing, with your definition of prior art, you say it's the cumulative body of knowledge of all people up to a given time. But if you're worried about conflicting with prior art, you have to redefine the prior art definition to say it's the cumulative body of all knowledge of all people minus your own. Because once you think of something, it's now part of prior art.
Fine.
Okay.
I'll add that.
Is the process equally as complex for a design patent?
I don't know.
Don't